Well, I think we'll make a start. I'm very pleased indeed to introduce this term's Majewski lecture by Dr. David Washbrook, who is from a reader in modern South Asian history at St. Anthony's. And he's going to talk to us this afternoon on Rationalism, Atheism, Hinduism in Dravidian India, 1920 to 1990. So without more ado, I'll pass it over to you.
Thank you very much, Gavin. Thank you very much for inviting me. I don't often give lectures at religious centres of religious study, and after this you may find out why. But anyway, to anyone who visits it, South India, and especially Tamil Nadu, must seem to be one of the most publicly religious places on earth, with its multiple temples, its little religious shrines on practically every street corner, and its penchant for great temple processions and major public festivals. I once remember meeting at Howrah railway station a Tamil friend of mine who was on his first visit to Calcutta, and we had hardly got far into that most secular of cities, Calcutta, before he turned to me and said, "What sort of a godless place is this?" And as anyone who studied the anthropology of Tamil society would know, religious ritual and practice wraps itself around local social life to a pervasive degree. It must be regarded as quite remarkable then that perhaps the only explicitly atheist popular movement which to my knowledge Indian society has ever generated should have emerged precisely within the context of Tamil Nadu itself. The self-respect or radical Dravidian movement led by the redoubtable E.V. Ramaswamy Nayakar, or Periyar, the Great One, as he was styled, which especially flourished between the 1920s and the 1940s. And it's that really that I want to, that paradox I want to concentrate on particularly in these remarks. Of course, Brahmanic Hinduism in the South had been challenged many times before by other religious traditions, Buddhism, Islam, in the 19th century especially Christianity. Indeed, insofar as Hinduism itself is concerned, and insofar as Hinduism itself can be defined, it might be said to consist of a series of sectarian traditions, often in open conflict and criticism with each other, a series of ongoing challenges to itself. But all these have always sought to replace one set of gods, one set of ethical principles, with another, held to be truer or more complete. However, what really distinguished self-respect or radical Dravidianism was the extent to which, at least ostensibly, it appeared to worship no gods, to attack the very idea of religious belief itself as superstition or institutionalized falsehood, and to call for its complete abolition. Periyar, it should be said, had very little time for Christianity, Islam, or Buddhism either, except that in the case of the first two, it seemed easier for Christians and Muslims to give them up. To quote him, "The Christians have set Christ aside and are deeply involved in scientific research in order to free men. They have realized that faith in religion and in God will take them nowhere, and have involved themselves in research and Puranas or religious, sorry, in God will take them nowhere, and have involved themselves in research and individual effort for advancement. After the Turks firmly discarded religion and Puranas or religious narratives, they have achieved a remarkable progress. When they firmly believed in religion and were singing Kalab songs, they were afraid of the gunpowder of the Europeans. Now the Europeans tremble before the Turks." But it was above all Hinduism that he attacked, because its influences for him were more difficult to dispel, and in terms of his own social values, were more problematic. To quote him again, "We have to say that it is only the Hindus who completely believe in religion, Puranas and other untruths, and are also utterly stupid and slavish. It is only we, the Hindus, who are subjected to disgrace in this country, India. Many people belonging to other religions have made laudable improvements in their religion and day by day have progressed in life. Even Muslims are more advanced than Hindus in many respects. Communal differences and the despicable grading of some people as high and some others as low are not found among Muslims. In a mosque, a ruler and his subjects offer worship together as equals. Some people may ask if the self-respect movement has been started only to destroy religion. I would declare that if a religion helps to eternalize communal evils and atrocious differences, the self-respect movement is there only to destroy that religion. If you really have the feeling of self-respect, I'm sure you will not hesitate to destroy the religious restrictions, gods and spirits, all of which obstruct your progress and freedom. It was then Hinduism, both Brahmanic Hinduism and, as it were, the popular institutionalized Hinduism of the South Indian temple, which drew Perrier's greatest ire and was the self-respect movement's principal focus of attention, and especially because of its paralyzing and divisive qualities, as he saw them, as represented in the institution of caste. And the movement set out very deliberately to shock South Indian society with its direct tactics, physically attacking temples in order to smash images of the gods, parading pictures of the gods in order to throw mud at them, formulating alternative forms of ritual, such as self-respect marriages, to satirize and displace Brahmanic equivalents. The movement also began to threaten Brahmins not only in their ritual roles, but in their own persons. It was informed by an ideology of Dravidianism, which held that Aryan Hinduism was a foreign imposition brought from the north, which had conquered and subordinated a pristine Dravidian culture based on equality and social harmony. The Brahmins were thus foreigners too, members of an alien race, and must needs be driven out with their false religion. One of Perrier's most quoted sayings, albeit that it's an adaptation from an old Tamil proverb, is that if you see a Brahmin and a snake on the road together, make sure that you kill the Brahmin first. And at least some of his followers would seem to have taken that literally, making parts of South India in the 1930s and 40s very uncomfortable for Brahmins. Far more uncomfortable than, say, for the British, who ironically one might regard as the real foreigners in this situation, but to whom self-respect was much more equivocal. Indeed, by the 1940s, as Indian national independence approached, it wasn't only the Brahmins, but the idea of a unitary India itself which started to be rejected. At the epochal 1937 elections, Perrier, for all his social radicalism, had cooperated with the loyalist and feudalist non-Brahmin Justice Party against the Indian National Congress. And after the Congress's victory had pointed the way towards a future self-governing Indian state, he decided that he wanted no part of it. His Dravidian movement dubbed Indian nationalism an Aryan conspiracy designed to bring the South under the tyranny of the North. And he began to demand a separate Dravidian state, Dravidistan, to flank Hindustan on the South in the way that it was proposed that Pakistan would flank it to the North. Dravidistan, or was it to be a Tamil state? In the 1920s and 30s, what one might term the linguistic element in identity conflicts had been relatively subdued, certainly in comparison to those suggested by broader concepts of race and civilization, where Dravidian civilization was frequently juxtaposed to Aryan civilization. Dravidianism here was not taken to be synonymous with Tamil, but rather was meant to apply across the whole of the South and to embrace the regions containing all four of the so-called Dravidian languages. As one might expect from somebody with Perrier's background, he came from the Balija Naidu caste, which is Telugu in origin, but his family had lived for hundreds of years deep in the Tamil country, in fact in Erode in Coimbatore, which of course is not very far from Kannadiga country. Perrier and the self-respect movement were never exclusively Tamilian. Dravidianism was a broader category for the South. However, the 1938 resolution of the Congress declaring Hindi to be the national language of India had a huge impact on Dravidian politics. It brought the question of discrete language much more to the fore. It spread a wave of resistance and resentment throughout Tamil Nadu, much more so than in any of the other regions of the South. One might feel this was because Tamilians had of course never seen their language as just a vernacular, some lower form of language to be put on a par with the many other languages of India. It had its own classical literature, which so many claimed was older and more refined than that of Sanskrit. If Sanskrit-derived Hindi was to be the language of the nation, it could only be at the expense of the glorious civilization and heritage of the Tamils. Anti-Hindi agitation began to spread through Tamil Nadu, and at one level greatly to enhance the popularity of the Dravidian movement with its anti-Northern biases. but it also threatened to split it, and ultimately came to transform it. Perrier, it should be said, in spite of subsequent attempts to rewrite history, was never very keen on abandoning a broader Dravidian for a narrower Tamil nationalism. Prior to 1938, he'd never really seen the language issue as particularly important. For example, and much to the embarrassment of subsequent generations, he can be found in the early 1930s opening Hindi schools in South India, which, when Hindi or Hindustani was just another vernacular, he thought could be useful in propagating his ideas more widely in India. And even afterwards, he was equivocal towards it and certainly disapproved of the language issue taking over from more significant questions of politicisation, such as criticism of the caste system and of religious superstition. But his influence over the movement started to be displaced by a younger generation of publicists, particularly those closely associated with the then-nascent Tamil language cinema, in which they were all closely involved. Most notably, the scriptwriter and producer C.N. Annadurai emerged by the late 1940s to challenge Perrier. From 1949, breaking away from the latter's Dravida Karagam, the Dravidian party, to form the Dravida Munetra Karagam, the Dravidian People's Party, which put the language issue at the top of its agenda and ultimately became much more politically successful. Annadurai, or Anna as he was universally known, built the DMK into an electoral party and famously in 1967 unseated a Congress government to initiate what has become virtually a dynastic succession of Dravidian governments who've ruled Tamil Nadu ever since. Perrier, as I was saying, really resisted or ignored this shift towards Tamil nationalism, but carried on regardless with his own brand of atheist racial politics, even using his DK to campaign with the Congress against the upstart DMK at the 1962 and 67 elections. But his star was very much in the waning, and it was Tamil nationalism that came to carry the day in Tamil Nadu, and also to alter much of the social meanings attached to the old Dravidianism. For example, if the Tamil language was now seen to be the core issue of identity, then why necessarily should Tamil Brahmins be pilloried anymore, since they spoke Tamil too? And indeed, any acquaintance with Tamil literary history would show that they were major contributors to its corpus of literature. Equally, if religion were practiced in Tamil, not merely in the local, long-standing tradition of Shaiva Siddhanta, but through translation of Sanskrit liturgy, why should it be problematic anymore? After all, it was now, by definition, the religion of the people. And even with regard to caste, there was copious evidence of its practice in the great classics of Tamil literature, which now inform the identity of the putative nation. As Marguerite Ross Barnett has argued, the shift from a Dravidian to a Tamil nationalist focus facilitated the de-radicalisation of the movement, which came progressively to compromise with all those evils which Perrier had set out to undo. The final stage now perhaps has been reached with one of the current heirs to the tradition, the leader of the AIA DMK, Jayalalitha Jayaram, herself a Brahmin and for that matter a Kannadiga, openly re-adopting caste marks and launching the largest programme of temple building and rebuilding which Tamil Nadu has probably ever seen since the 17th century. History in the end came full circle. And by most standards, the radical Dravidian challenge proved to be a failure. Religion, and certainly Hinduism, have not been destroyed in Tamil Nadu, which remains the land of the gods. But I think the challenge was an interesting one and certainly doesn't deserve to be entirely forgotten. Nor in every way was it entirely unsuccessful. With regard to social practices such as caste, it has contributed to an important transformation in the nature of South Indian Hinduism itself, if not from Perrier's point of view, at all a complete one. So what lay behind it? What lay behind this unlikeliest of atheist political movements arising in the land of the gods? It can best be seen as arising at the point of convergence between three perhaps different strands or skeins of South Indian history. One skein, of course, would be the history of the religion, or religions, which we call Hinduism, over the previous millennium. There were traditions of identity and rivalry which self-consciously associated themselves with the South and the North, with Sanskrit as opposed to Tamil language liturgies and rituals. Many Sri Vaishnava temples, for example, were deeply riven with disputes between Vadagalai, literally northern, and Tengalai, literally southern, schools of ritual practice, the latter featuring non-Brahmins in more prominent roles. The Shaiva Siddhanta tradition also gave special prominence to Tamil and Tamil hymns, and there was a well-institutionalized tradition of non-Brahmin priesthood. Disputes over caste, too, were etched into southern culture over a very long period, particularly in relation to bhakti movements. Of course, in their own time, none of these had the meaning which latter-day Dravidianism would give to them. Sanskrit and Tamil were not seen as exclusive of each other. The great non-Brahmin mutts in the south collected manuscripts as avidly in Sanskrit as they did in Tamil. Important stone and copperplate inscriptions feature both languages. The royal courts of the region patronized poets and writers in both and many more languages. Equally, caste models promoted emulation of the Brahmin as much as rivalry and rejection. The high Tamil Valala culture openly imitated that of the Brahmin. Nonetheless, a language of difference did exist for later ages to adopt and appropriate for their own purposes. Famously, Benedict Anderson has argued that nationalism proceeds on the basis of imagination. Nations, such as that of the Dravidian Tamils, are imagined constructs. But if they're going to be successful, they have to be imagined on the basis of historical terms which people can recognise, with which they have some familiarity. Nations are not made up out of thin air. Here there was an inherited vocabulary of difference on which to build national imagination of difference, and which could gain popular recognition. A second strand of history feeding into this can be seen in the impact of colonialism itself, although precisely what that impact was is in some dispute among historians. One aspect of it, though, seems clear enough: the impact of 19th century Protestant evangelical Christianity. Christianity, in its Greek and Roman versions, had woven itself into South Indian cultural life and fabric over a long period. But by and large, it wound itself around the existing warp. As Susan Bailey particularly has argued, before 1800, both Roman and Greek Christianity functioned more or less in the idiom of Hindu sects and accommodated themselves to southern tradition. But the onslaught of Protestant evangelicals in the middle decades of the 19th century was a different order. It set out deliberately to challenge Hinduism, especially over the practices of caste. This followed from a conversion strategy which took Brahmins, the supposed priesthood of Hinduism, to possess a strong hold over society, which must needs be broken and undermined if Christianity were to make room for itself. Protestant missions singled out Brahmins and Brahminism for attack, and as Nicholas Dirks particularly has seen, elaborated complex theories of civilization to justify that attack. The idea of a separate Dravidian race, held subject to an alien Aryan race, represented by the Brahmins, was the work of the highly influential mid-19th century missionary Robert Caldwell, who also played a key role in the literary revival of Tamil. Aryan race theory, which itself supposed some kind of primeval racial connection between the Indian elite and the British, on which a common empire might be built, and a classic example of which you can see in the portico to the history faculty here in Broad Street, which used to be the Indian Institute, where the ICS, Indian Civil Service, were trained. And the translation of the plaque proclaims the building dedicated to the joint use of the Aryas, brackets, English and Indian. So the theory of the Aryan race theory was extremely strong and popular, particularly in the early to mid-19th century. And what Caldwell did here was to turn it round, in the process rather cleverly of concealing the extent to which the British themselves are also members of the Aryan race. But he tried to turn it into a tool for freeing a supposedly oppressed Dravidian people from the oppressions of Aryan, specifically Brahmanic Hinduism. Dravidian fallen race theory then was very well established in colonial and especially missionary discourse long before Perrier took it up. But more contentious in the current historiography There's a question of where Brahmin social and political power in 19th century South Indian may have come from. Although there's no dispute, I think, that this power was actually rising. Brahmins, although only 3% of the population, completely dominated the elite institutions of the colonial state and of education. Their influence over the endowment and administration of the temples, those very key institutions in South Indian life, was also manifest in the imposition of more rigid rules of caste etiquette on rituals and practice, in contrast to the fluid and contestative relations which, as Arjun and Karal Appadurai have seen, characterised temporal relations in earlier epochs. Indeed, formal rules of caste etiquette were being more elaborately enforced everywhere in 19th century South India, especially via the courts of law, which were inclined towards literal interpretations of the Sanskrit scriptures. In one case, for example, at the great Kumbakonam temple in Tanjore, this meant that an old and wealthy Nada family might still be regarded as honoured donors to the temple and even allowed to sit on its committee of trustees that were administering it. But progressively they were denied access to it, because as caste rules became more rigidified, the fact that they were from untouchable origins became more widely known, and they were cut out from actually participating in this temple with which they'd been associated for a long time. All this caste literalism and Brahmin so-called arrogance contrasted with the situation in medieval times, when Brahmins in the south had been much more the servants and clients of non-Brahmin kings and authorities, dependent on them for endowments, and less in a position to question their authority. Nicholas Dirks makes this shift entirely a function of colonial rule, which both removed the political power of the kings, of non-Brahmin kings, which once had held Brahmins in check, and then exalted the latter's influence by turning to Brahmanic scriptures to found its codes of law. Brahmins constituted the principal informants on whom the British drew for their knowledge of Indian tradition, and were, in this version, hoodwinked into validating what previously may only have been Brahmin fantasies about Varnashrama Dharma. However, Susan Bailey has argued that certain aspects of this shift were probably imminent in southern society even before the colonial conquest, which in many ways just picked them up and brought them to a more complete fulfilment. They really lay in the transition in the nature of the Indian state, which was taking place from the later 17th century, as the old Mughal imperium declined. In regional successor states of the 18th century particularly, power over money became much more important than power over the sword. Indeed, power over money bought power over the sword. As a result, more effective paper administrations and bureaucracy began to develop, which passed authority increasingly to those with the skills of the pen rather than those of the sword, which is to say, predominantly to upper caste elites and above all Brahmins. The model was set by the Peshwas of Pune, Chitpavan Brahmins, who famously ousted the heirs to Shivaji, the warrior rulers of Satara, to take state power into their own hands, and immediately to institute a Brahmin Raj, a Raj where scriptural and caste authority would play a more leading role in social relations. Something of the same took place in the Maratha Tanjore court in Tamil Nadu, which became noticeably Sanskritized and Brahminized, and also in Travancore to the southwest, where the new state of Matandavarma in the mid-18th century rested on an especially close compact with the Nambudiri Brahmins. Kingship and power then were already changing, and the British, if you like, walked into a society which was already undergoing a significant degree of Brahminization, becoming more susceptible to Brahmanic influence and the rigidities of caste which it brought and which they carried forward. But however that historical debate is viewed, the results by the turn of the 20th century remain much the same, and from some angles were threatening to become worse. As political discourse turned towards nationalism and Indian self-government, from the angle of many in southern and, of course, also western India, this promised to remove the final checks to Brahmin dominance and dominion. The British, at least, had tried to preserve an element of religious neutrality in their dealings with Indian culture and temples, which up to a point had meant that Brahmin aspirations had been limited by established non-Brahmin customary rights. But from 1920, with the passing of the Montague-Chelmsford reforms and the beginnings of representative government, these checks began to ease. While a sense of their own alienness, weakness and vulnerability had led the British to avoid so-called interference in religious matters, the same wasn't the case when legislatures were in the hands of Indians themselves. Immediately, a slew of bills appeared to reform various aspects of Hindu custom and law. But in the South, one of these prominently featured the attempts of a Dharma Rakshana Sabha, consisting entirely of Brahmins, to take the administration of all the major temples in the South away from local, predominantly non-Brahmin trustees and into their own hands. Added to this, a movement appeared among Tamil Brahmins, inclined by this time to regard their good fortune in the 19th century as the product more of divine than of British intervention, to utilise the growing legislative powers available to impose a truer Ram Raj. Namely, they set up a Varnashrama Dharma Sabha aimed at changing the law to enforce even fuller forms of caste exclusion and separation on the South than had been the case even up till then. It was against this background, of course, that an increasingly strong non-Brahmin reaction began to set in, a challenge to the rising social power enjoined by Brahmins. Although initially it was a fairly conservative challenge, based more on claiming a share of Brahmin privilege for the upper non-Brahmin castes and a share of Sanskrit literature's kudos for Tamil literature, than an outright challenge to privilege itself. Perrier eventually would be almost as contemptuous of Valalas and upper caste South Indians as he was of Brahmins. But to account for the radicalising of non-Brahminism, for its turn towards Dravidianism, I think we may need also to look at a third strand of history, the emergence of ideologies of modernism and of nationalism. As those quotations with which I began indicate, Perrier was in many ways an unregenerate modernist. He venerated progress, science, rationalism, which he saw providing the path to knowledge and freedom. For this reason, of course, he was especially equivocal about the colonial presence, which he considered to have introduced these possibilities into India. But the purposes to which he wanted to put them were also indisputably nationalist. In the end, his Dravidian nation had a right to its own self-determination, which it could best achieve by modernising itself. His social thinking was very much in line with that of other radical nationalists of his time, not merely in India, but much more generally. He saw a modernising transformation of society as essential to national strength and autonomy. In fact, as the mention of Turkey in that quotation I gave earlier indicates, he was particularly, in the 1920s, an admirer of Kemal Atatürk, whose programme of reform in Turkey he wished to copy. And later on, after he'd visited Russia, he became a great admirer of Stalin, whom he saw, probably quite rightly, as being a much more a Russian nationalist, you know, than a Soviet communist. Until the mid-1920s, he'd also thrown his lot in with an Indian nationalism, participating in the non-cooperation movement and even going to jail. But Indian nationalism became increasingly problematic for him. First, there was this local problem in Madras, where Congress was dominated by Brahmins whose vision of a free India was not his own. Here, some of the leading congressmen of the time, people like S. Srinivasa Iyengar, were known sympathisers with both the Varnashrama Dharma and Dharma Rakshana Sabhas. The British Raj would give way only to an uncompromising Brahmin Raj here. But second, there was the cultural character of the putative Indian nation itself and its supposed aims and goals. Alongside Indian nationalism from the later 19th century, there also rose a much more explicit Hindu nationalism, which looked back to a glorified Brahmanic culture to give the new nation its identity. Moreover, as William Gould particularly has argued in his recent Indian Nationalism and the Language of Politics, as the Congress became a mass movement in the 1920s and 30s, so its supposed secularism became increasingly compromised by imbrication in this other Hindu nationalist movement or project. Also, its commitment to radical social goals, while maintained theoretically, became clouded by association with an ideology which denounced all forms of modernism and wanted to go back to some kind of pristine village-based community and society. Both of these tendencies, of course, were closely associated with the rise of Mahatma Gandhi, and Gandhi was Perrier's explicit nemesis. He set out very deliberately to be Gandhi's other. It was a joke, really, that he came to be called Perrier, which means in Tamil the Great One, because Mahatma means the great soul. So he said, you know, well, he calls himself the great soul, I don't see why I can't call myself the great one. Whereupon everybody started calling him the great one. Perrier was picked up satirically. He also took to dressing in a black dhoti as a counterpart to Gandhi's white. He emphasised, to an almost paranoid point, the virtues of violence as opposed to Gandhian non-violence. And most obviously, he proposed to meet Gandhi's vision of Ram Raj with a Raj in which there were to be no gods at all. In the early 1920s, he'd campaigned alongside Gandhi in non-cooperation, and later also at the Vaikom Satyagraha, which was aimed against the exclusion of untouchables from temple entry. But the parting of the ways had come in 1925, as he began to suspect that Gandhi's own social reform-oriented neo-Hinduism was merely palliative, and would in fact leave the political door open for the entry of a very different and much more aggressive kind of Hindu nationalism, actually to rule the roost. And thereafter, I think that many of the extremities of his positions can be seen from the extent to which they were meant as deliberate reversals of Gandhi's own positions. He wanted to outrage Gandhi's most cherished values, religion, non-violence, anti-modernism. Hence he smashed gods, preached Brahmin elimination, and proselytized on behalf of modern science. He was Gandhi's other. But intriguingly, and is often the case with others, he may also have shared a great deal in common with that which he sought to deny. If one reads his writings, there's an extraordinary duality in them. On the one hand, there's all this bluster about rationalism, technology and progress, about atheism and annihilating the gods, about abolishing caste, and so on. But on the other, there's the question of really, well, what social ends was all this meant to achieve? What would his purged Dravidian community actually look like as a social artefact? And ironically, it may not look terribly different from Gandhi's village community. It would have been a simple society of people who treated each other on a basis of equity, where, like Gandhi, he was as much opposed to the modern differentiation of class as ever he was to that of caste. He personally inherited and ran a prosperous family mercantile business within which he abolished wages as a symbol of slavery, favouring instead to offer his staff a share in the business. Also, in describing his ideal social model, he found himself making more and more appeals to a golden age past, much as did Gandhi. The goals of the Dravidian community were to recover its original prehistorical roots before the incursions of Aryanism and Brahmanism had overcome and divided it, to return it to the simple egalitarian principles on which supposedly it had previously existed. Very ironically, then, science, technology and atheism were going to bring it back to what it had once been and always should have been. Perrier believed as much in a prehistorical golden age as did Gandhi himself, and perhaps inevitably so. Futuristic utopias, of which by definition no one can have any experience, are hardly emotionally satisfying. Appeals to a at least half-remembered or felt past touch the emotions much more surely. And I'm not sure it wasn't this golden past, as well as the curious way that he organised and elaborated the self-respect movement, that wasn't the principal attraction to his followers, the reasons why in the 20s and 30s a lot of people followed him, battered by the economic recession and the Great Depression. He offered the vision of a simple, better society free from the vagaries of oppression and of capitalism and caste. And after all, what could his appeals to the modernism of Ataturk and later of Stalin, his later role model, have meant to the majority of his audience, locked away in their small corner of the world, without his linguistic skills and money to read and travel widely all over Europe, the Near East, and eventually to Stalin's Russia itself? I think that side of his rhetoric was meant for his fellow intellectuals, but what brought him popular support and made him important in Tamil Nadu lay elsewhere. in addition to the idea of a return to lost simplicities, there was also the ways that, ironically, he used the styles and rituals of popular Hinduism to propagate, ironically, his doctrines of irreligion. For example, the self-respect movement itself developed an internal honours system, very much like that to be found inside the South Indian temple. Donors to and supporters of the movement were given titles and favours from Perrier, the Great One, standing in for the gods in much the same way that through prasadam rituals and so on, donors to a South Indian temple are honoured by the gods. Also, the movement developed its own rituals to displace those of formal religion, most notably, as I was saying, marriage ceremonies. Perrier regularly toured the South celebrating self-respect, which is to say explicitly cross-caste marriages, in due ritual and solemnity. Of course, self-respect marriages were not meant to have the pomp and circumstance, and certainly not the attached dowries of conventional weddings. But Tamil society itself could take care of that problem. Once I was upbraided in Madras for questioning Perrier's credentials as a moderniser and secularist by a professor who, when he was a boy, remembered that Perrier had come to celebrate a self-respect marriage in his own village and how impressed the whole village had been by this. So I asked him whether it was true that the self-respect campaign against dowries and the expenses of conventional marriage had been really effective. And he conceded, well, not quite, because the day after Perrier left, we all got together and had a proper wedding. Nonetheless, we were all very proud that he had come to see us. Most notably, too, and I think most importantly, as one critic of self-respect famously put it, under Perrier, the Tamil stopped worshipping the gods and started worshipping their own ancestors. The internal cultural self-respect, and even more of Dravidianism, came to resurrect historical figures from the past to stand for and represent precisely the kind of transcendental values that the Hindu gods had done, to be worshipped and venerated as if they were gods. In particular, the cult of Kotta Bowman, a late 18th century warrior, began to become very widely popular and to particularly distinguish the Dravidian movement. But this, of course, chimed with a very important feature of Tamil folk religion as practiced in the villages, the worship of hero stones, stones left to commemorate the deeds of great warriors and the lives of great warriors and satis and so on. In Tamil folk culture, the gods always were kind of heroes, they're represented as such, and the human heroes gods. Perrier's irreligion, so far as the great gods of the Hindu pantheon were concerned, was matched by a strong devotion to the heroes of the Tamil past. At this level, Dravidianism became a form of religion itself, not a denial of it. With ritual, belief, and so on, it became increasingly a mirror image of particularly temple Hinduism, which it set out to deny. Self-respect and Dravidian and the Dravidian movement then were full of contradictions, denunciations of religion and appeals to modernism, masking the revival of at least folk religious traditions and appeals to a pristine prehistorical community. As I said, it is at least possible to suspect that it was really these latter themes which provided it with its greatest appeal. And it's also, I think, that appeal that helps to explain the relative ease with which an erstwhile radical Dravidianism came to be de-radicalised in the course of its transition to Tamil nationalism. For it was very much those elements or sentiments which Anna captured with his shift in the focus of discourse to the Tamil language. Exactly what a pre-Aryan Dravidian past might have looked like was always going to be largely conjectural, since there were no historical remains of it. But what a glorious Tamil past looked like, or at least felt like, was evident in Tamil literary tradition, which was of course being very strongly revived from the later 19th century. Print culture, and even more in a society where the majority of the population was illiterate, film culture disseminated it widely and started to make it actually visible. If the demands of emotionalism require that a utopian future be made on the basis of a utopian past, a Tamil past had much more going for it than any Dravidian past. In the manner suggested by both Benedict Anderson and Ernest Gellner, it was in many sense produced by the modern media revolution, which places language at the core of identity. film particularly propagated images and a culture of the Tamil world, which became increasingly convincing. And as Sumati Ramaswamy has suggested, passions of the tongue were always likely to be much more powerful in this context than any passions of race, caste, civilization, religion, or anything else. You could hear it, you could see it, particularly on the screen. And from the 1940s, it progressively supplanted these other concerns and issues. Perrier, as I indicated, himself refused to accept this. He belonged to a different age. And indeed, in the 1950s, he became positively anti-Tamil, refusing to participate in the language agitation as it grew in the 1950s, and which he took to be a distraction from the real issues of caste and oppression, and once famously even describing Tamil as a barbaric language. Rather, his politics moved closer to those of the Untouchables, whom he had dubbed Adi Dravidas, the first Dravidians, and to the Communist Party, with whom he jointly led campaigns in the Deep South, attempting to improve the conditions of Panayals, agricultural labourers mostly from untouchable castes. But this progressively marginalised him from the mainstream of Tamil politics. Annadurai now took the lead, placing his faith in the glorious past and futures of those who spoke Tamil, celebrating their history and their sense of shared community. Anna himself sought to maintain at least a vestige of Perrier's old radicalism, proclaiming himself a Marxist betimes, and in his films regularly berating the rich, even those who weren't Brahmins. But the exigencies of politics began to overtake the movement as it sought to expand its political base. And as I indicated earlier, a vision of the Tamil past explicitly, one particularly fixated on literature and the literature of the Sangam age, could hardly repudiate Brahmins entirely, nor gods nor castes, since they're all fully reflected in it. Tamil nationalism steadily became more incorporative than racial Dravidianism ever had been, proclaiming the unity of all those who venerated Tamil culture, including Brahmins. Indeed, in the late 1950s, Anna dispelled all doubts about this when he effectively became the political chela of that wily old Brahmin and former Gandhian Rajagopalacharya, with whose extremely conservative and Brahmin Swatantra Party Anna's DMK allied at both the 1962 and 67 elections against the Congress. The triumph of an inclusivist Tamil nationalism marked the effective end of an exclusionary Dravidianism, which, with Perrier's death at the age of 94 in 1973, passed slowly into the history books. But its passage throws light, I think, on some key dilemmas of nationalism. In the early nationalist era, it is very characteristic of nationalist thought in the 1920s, 1930s. How should one formulate the character of an emergent nation? What culture and traditions might bind its members, or some of them, together into what kind of community? If nationalism is a modernist ideology predicated on values of equality, how should one view a past marked by social inequality and hierarchy? Could one build a viable modern society on the basis of inequity? Yet if one sought to build a new national community without any reference to a traditional past, what would hold it together? Who would believe in it? Perrier was dealing with the classic dilemmas of nationalism and nation building, albeit that he came up with some highly idiosyncratic answers. Among those idiosyncrasies were some serious contradictions so far as religion was concerned. To evade the implications of Brahmanism and caste, he denounced religion and proclaimed himself an atheist. But actually what he was doing was to build on and revive traditions of popular religion, of folk religion, bound up with hero worship, which have continued ever since, albeit by the ministrations of a later Tamil nationalism, which has now reblended that tradition back into the major Hindu pantheon by restoring, as it were, the status of South Indian temple worship. As it were, what that movement did was to put Katha Bohman and Shiva back together so that they might speak to each other jointly and help to define the Tamil nation and speak to each other in Tamil.
Thank you, Dr. Mishra. Very interesting. I open the chair for questions, please. If I can start, actually, now, that was really interesting about the idea that Perrier was, he's a very strong atheist, and he seems to be getting at atheism, and linking atheism with progress, which is a very sort of Western sort mm-hmm. of idea, really. So he's getting that from the West, presumably, to some extent. And he's also then trying to link back to his own tradition. But he didn't look back to his own tradition for resources of atheism within it. I'm thinking there's a parallel with Ambedkar in the north, who was fighting for the scheduled caste and so on, with reference to Buddhism, another atheistic philosophy. So I was thinking there are parallels between them, but Ambedkar's looking to the ancient Indian past.
I think that's true of anyone who's involved in trying to define a nation. It has to rest on some sense of an historical community, a traditional community. I mean, the problem for all nationalists, but it's a problem in spades in India, is finding some unitary basis on which you can develop this idea of a nation. So you have to go to a very, very distant past, preferably one that no one can remember, as it were, in order to do it. So they are, those things are very, I think, very much, as it were, matched together. He proclaims himself an atheist and he attacks the Brahmin gods. And he's never explicit about what the alternative is. But I think I'm trying to suggest that implicitly, in the way that he acted, utilising temple ritual, going for heroes, which has a very strong tradition of hero worship and so on, he was in fact covertly building another religion, even though he was saying that he wasn't doing it. And I think that's why he was popular. Because being an atheist in South India doesn't make any sense at all.
I was going to raise the question of the way history was being written in the 20th, 19th and 20th century, and the fact that the whole writing of history was indeed a colonial project, in which certainly, there were Indians, but the whole notion of history, the way it was defined, and the way it was put together, it really took off from the European tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the whole notion of race and language, which emerged, from a European tradition of race and language. So at one level, what is interesting is that, how the nation is to be perceived, or how the past of this nation is to be perceived, was completely a colonial intervention. And within this then, there were these various shades. There were the Dravidians, there were the Aryans, which took off from, again, this project of language, race, and so on and so forth. And in a way then, to me it seems that one way of getting out of this would be to see what form education took, or what was being taught, and was there an alternative tradition of teaching something else. And I was just wondering if you could...
Well, it's very interesting. Nationalism itself is a, in certain sense, the modern nation state is a Western idea, so all this is within that sort of tradition. I think the sort of education system is really very interesting, much more conflictual than sometimes it's represented. At one level, the teaching establishment is in the hands of Brahmins. On the other hand, there is a missionary strand, which is in fact highly critical of Brahmins, so that you do have quite a contestation about the meanings of southern history, particularly precisely around these kinds of issues. It's particularly the missionary strand which I think is important here, and was not only that Perry is picking up on it, but Ambedkar was missionary educated, and certainly all the untouchable political leaders were, because it was the only way they could get to school. And there is a fairly explicit line, I think, of development from that missionary attempt to critique Indian society in a way that would create a space for Christian missionary activities to develop. But it was always being questioned by the extent to which there was another history. I suppose the classic example of the Brahmin history of South India is a very fine historian, Nilakanta Shastri, who in some ways wrote what certainly when I was a student was regarded as the proper history of South India. But it's actually a very, very Brahmanic view. It doesn't take up these sorts of issues, as it were, at all, and rather slides over the question of conflict. I think it's there. But I think an important point is it's not just comes from the West. There were elements in the past, such as Tengalai, Radhagalai controversy within the temples. I mean, those words mean north and south. They're there, people use them. What the hell people meant by them, no one really knows in the 15th century. But if in the 20th century, it's a discourse that with people are relevant. There is a perceived difference between south and north on which to develop these things. And so there are strands from the from Indian society itself, its own cultural history, as it were, informing this. But clearly, I mean, the non-Brahmin reaction is a reaction against a position of dominance that Brahmins only established in the south in the context of colonialism, which removed checks on them, which institutionalised them as having the authoritative voice over Indian culture, and which in the south made no sense, where they're 3% of the population and there are no flanking Kshatriyas or Vaishyas. I mean, you're 3% of the population and you set yourself up against 97%, you'll get into trouble. And that is indeed what happened. Sorry, there was another hand. Yeah.
Your paper reminds me of a paper I heard 2 years ago at the British Association of Study of Religion here in Oxford, and the lady argued that also in Stalin, in the case of Stalin, Mao Zedong, and a few other of these communist leaders at that time, that they, in one sense, tried to replace God and get rid of God, but they also, either intentionally or unintentionally, became gods. Mm-hmm. By the people they ruled, and maybe they created themselves that way as well. And are you saying the similar sort of thing happened?
Well, that certainly happened to him. I mean, he became one of the heroes. You know, Jaya Lalita, who's this former film star, who's now one of the leading influences in political influence in South India, had this Dravidian history represented on the beach in Madras, and if you know it, it's sort of this tremendous marina beach, in a series of cutouts, which began with Katabhoman and then sort of moved on to Peri. Shiva was there somewhere, sort of particular there. Then Katabhoman and going on through Anadurai and so on, to herself. So it's all meant to be a lineage. Of course, her cutout was about 8 times bigger than anybody else's. But the style of Tamil politics is very much about heroes. We had this phenomenal MGR cult, M.G. Ranchandran, who was, again, a film star, became a sort of leading political figure. And yes, I mean, there is veneration that's involved here. The day that MGR died, 65 people committed suicide in sympathy and couldn't live without it. I mean, that is a special kind of charisma. And to a degree, his was sexual chemistry. That wasn't true in the case of Terrier, if you've ever seen him. It was some other kind of chemistry, especially when he was 94. But he certainly, there was certainly a very, very strong sort of popular personal connection. People supported him. I mean, whether, again, how far they actually internalised what he was saying, shared his philosophy, you know, it's terribly difficult to work things out. But he was hugely popular and very much became the focus of a cult. Yeah.
Is that a kind of, when you were saying we share a great deal in common with what you seek to deny, is that an instance directly with Gandhi where he kind of takes a page out of Gandhi's own playbook?
Yes, I mean in the sense that that's what he deliberately wanted to do. He wanted to be the other Gandhi. He wanted to be literally the black Gandhi, given the South's connotations with Ravana and blackness. The DNK colour is black. I mean, it's not usually the most popular of colours around it. It has a very specific set of connotations. No, he very, very deliberately in the 20s and 30s was Gandhi's name. He did exactly the opposite of what Gandhi did in all sorts of ways, particularly violence, atheism, modernism. These are all explicit motifs reversed in Gandhi's case. And he built up quite a popular following in Tamil Nadu. I mean, I don't think anybody else understood him. I mean, he didn't have that way, even though he was a Dravidian rather than a Tamil. he didn't have much of a following outside Tamil Nadu. He's very much working within the idioms of Tamil Nadu itself. And anyone outside would think, what an extraordinary way to behave. But it had a lot of meaning within it, within its own context. So Gandhi didn't like going to Tamil Nadu. At least Tamil Nadu was Periyar's place. It wasn't Gandhi's place.
This goes to us. I mean, when he was preaching violence, it seems so opposite to what I know, little I know of the Indian national character. How was it received in general?
Oh, well, there was quite a bit of violence. Yes, I mean, this notion of a non-violent society is problematic anyway, but in a society that worships heroes, I mean, Cutter Bowman is explicitly a warrior. He fought the British hanged him in about 1792. He led an armed insurrection. But hero stones, a lot of these hero stones are to warriors, and the idea of warrior kingship is very much part of the tradition. I mean, and very much, you know, that. I mean, there's not a lot of veneration for the institution of kingship in the South. Again, there's an old Tamil saying that the only difference between a king and a bandit is that the king's been successful. But on the other hand, they like success, and if you are a successful warrior and so on, you'll be remembered forever. I mean, there's some very particular cultural traditions in Tamil Nadu. I mean, one, as you possibly know, quite a lot of Tamil castes don't burn their dead. They either bury them or, in the case of a great warrior, they chop them up into little bits, and the bits are circulated round so that you have contact with the charisma and power of the great warrior and so on. There's very much a warrior element in folk culture, which, for example, the LTTE in Sri Lanka really builds up and very much develops that side of Tamil culture. So they're not all that non-violent.
You know, the same thing happened in Andhra, where you again have the cult of the actors. And and in Andhra it happens because the epic stories are, they form the main themes of the film. Mm. Does that happen in Tamil Nadu?
Not so much. No, I mean, that's one thing, but no, Andhra never really went with his atheism. I mean, he wasn't terribly popular there. It's much more... it's a much more Sanskritized Dravidianism. Brahmins are much more integrated into the society. There's some, but there's much less non-Brahmin tension there. No, and it was very much playing up the epics, N.T. Ramarao, playing the gods and that. That wasn't true here. No, I mean, M.G. Ramachandran, the great role was this sort of uncle that was always looking after people and sorting out people's problems. It was a very sort of avuncular thing. He was the represented good in that way, but it was fairly secular. He played heroes. He once played a cowboy in one of the strangest films I've ever seen, because it was at the time he was also running a prohibition campaign. And there's this wonderful scene of him going into a bar and pushing through the doors with his guns and so on, and going up to things and banging on the bar and saying, coffee. He was in prohibition mode at the time. So, but it was more secular. Well, I don't know, that's a problematic word. It was not explicitly in a religious idiom, although it might be implicitly in a religious idiom.
Has there been an apotheosis of Periyar himself? I mean, has he become a divine being?
Well, in the Dravidian cult, within the Dravidian movement itself, yes. No, there are images of him.
There are images.
Although that's been stopped. I mean, the great Tamil wars, as you probably know, that the split in the Dravidian parties, Karunanidhi and the DMK as opposed to MGR's ADMK. And for a time that was carried out through sort of poster and statue wars. But particularly huge cutouts on the beach and film posters and statues. I mean, one of the great rows, it's an ongoing row, is that Karunanidhi, the leader of the DMK, who's out of power, when he was in power, he commissioned a series of statues of himself to go up in various, mainly at the main roundabouts in Madras and Chennai. But then he lost power, and Jayalalitha, his nemesis, cancelled them. And this is a huge... insult. He's waiting to get back into power so that he can get his statues up and so on. But one thing is that there's been changes in the electoral laws. I mean, the Electoral Commission is a wonderful organisation, but they are spoil sports. And they said that, you know, all this posted, but, well, they brought in very, very strict election expenses rules, and you can't actually afford to put these huge great posters up anymore. And if you do, they then want to know where the money came from, and awkward questions start being asked. So elections aren't nearly as colourful as they used to be down south. But certainly these are huge images and so on. I mean, they're in a way, it's all an extrapolation of temple culture, as you know, in South India, processions, carrying the gods around, all these kinds of things. A lot of so-called secular culture is in fact taking over those rituals and idioms and just moving it into different areas. But the religious thing is not nearly so important now. I mean, as I say, Tamil nationalism is Tamilized religion, and therefore it's part of us, and therefore, you know, it's fine. Shiva and Gata Bowman are the same thing. I mean, and if you look at the history of Murugan and so on, they probably always were.
Any more questions?
Actually, the follow-up question I had was, then in what sense is the whole word religion really meaningful?
Well, it's a big problem.
Does it say something about human nature?
Oh, I think so. I mean,
in different countries, and you have in China and Russia and India, these...
I mean, I think if you take it to mean transcendental values, ultimate values, then it's you can't live without it. You certainly can't have a nation without it. You can't have a state without it. I mean, one of the attributes of a state is to take people's lives legitimately. It has to have a transcendental justification for that. I think when people are attacking religion, they're attacking particular organised forms of it. As in Perrier's case, he was particularly attacking this... kind of Brahminized ritual, which, you know, in a very real sense, I don't have time to talk about it, did take the religion away from the people. I mean, the great sort of medieval South Indian temple tradition, like most medieval traditions, would by many modern standards be regarded as total chaos. I mean, people contested each other's right to attend different festivals, ritual orders moved, the whole thing was, you know, moving. People who rose in the world, you know, by endowing the gods, could effectively change their status, all this kind of thing. This is the real popular world of religion. What you got, particularly under colonialism, was the attempt to enforce scripturally derived rules of caste and varna onto a popular South Indian temple institution, which has, of course, had nothing to do with Sanskrit scripture and philosophy or anything like that. It's a set of public practices. And the effect of it was that lower caste, I mean, above all untouchables, who got kicked out completely. But even lower castes found themselves very restricted. You know, they couldn't get to the gods. The gods had been taken away from them. Perrier reflects a sort of an aspect of that, which is that, you know, therefore the gods are no damn good. It's their fault. I can't get to them. Let's get rid of the gods. But once things changed again, rules of untouchability and caste broke down, temple Hinduism has changed a lot in the last 50 to 60 years. I mean, the Vaikom Satyagraha was protesting against a practice that kept untouchables out of temples. They weren't anywhere near it. In the 18th century, because they were big and strong, it was particularly Burians who used to carry the gods around when they were festivals. The 19th century, not allowed within 128 feet of them. It was the imposition of those rules which literally took the gods away from the people, I think, which led to these sorts of sentiments. And Perrier's was one response, let's get rid of the gods then. That wasn't satisfying because there wasn't in fact anything to put in their place. And now we have got the gods back. We can go back to them. So I think that was part and parcel of it.
Thank you.
Okay.
The Jayalaliti you mentioned, I actually... I was thrown out of a hotel room once because they wanted it for her.
Oh no! Well, probably wasn't. It was for her security guard.
Yeah.
She has this obsession that the Tamil tigers are trying to kill her. So everything has to be cleared when she's about. When she travels from her home in Nungambakkam up to Parliament, you know, in Chennai, no one can move in the streets. I mean, you know, the streets are sort of cleared for miles around.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Marshall. It was a really interesting lecture. Thank you so much.